Sometimes the most interesting stories get left on the cutting room floor. I'm Julie Amacher. Each week I share a new classical recording with you featuring some of the world's best musicians on new classical tracks. Over the next 6 weeks, I'm counting down six of my favorite interviews from 2016. It's New Classical Tracks Uncut, giving you a chance to hear more about your favorite musicians and their newest recordings. This week, a conversation from August of 2016 with the legendary Pincus Zukerman.
Julie.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. Is this Pincus Zukerman?
It sure is.
Well, I'm very glad to hear from you. I was reading a little bit about your thoughts about being a conductor, and you mentioned that it was really important to you, and you seem to think it's important in general, that if someone wants to be a conductor, that they actually start studying that early in their career rather than, you know, making a name for yourself as a solo artist and then kind of dabbling in it. Can you talk a little bit about that and why that's so important?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because we start playing instruments when we're very young because we need to get physical dexterity, coordination, eye-hand coordination, learning to read the music, produce the sound, etc. Well, I don't suggest necessarily a six-year-old with a baton in front of 85 people playing Eroica Symphony, conducting Eroica Symphony, but why does it only start at 25 or 30? I think that's too late. The younger you can start, the cleaner the brain is, the more susceptible it is for good information. And we see now with many places, especially in Venezuela, when you have an extraordinary array of players that come from the orchestra, people that come out of the orchestra, that start conducting 14, 15, 16 already in the system while playing in the orchestra, which is unique. We start conducting here because people can't make a career. So they say, well, I'll dabble around in conducting. Well, that's not good enough. Or the other, even worse, you make a name as a player and then you start conducting without really going into it thoroughly. And I think that's a mistake. That's just a terrible mistake. You have to spend as much time, or maybe sometimes more, learning the parts. First of all, you have to mark your parts. And then I don't care what instrument you play, you got to mark the string parts because that's your DNA. When you come to an orchestra, you bring that part to a violin, to a viola, to a cello, for that matter, to the winds, where you have some dynamic markings, etc., doubling sometimes. You learn that. That's a way of learning how the score goes, how the score will speak to you. And you, in turn, can then speak to the orchestra. You have to have a physical ability. You can't play tennis one day and become a baseball player the next day. It doesn't work. Or for that matter, you know, race driving, and then you become a jockey on a horse. It doesn't work like that. So it's the same metaphor. Seriously, you can't just start conducting because you've made yourself a name as a player. I started learning to conduct when I was about 16. I was very curious about the orchestra. I played a lot of chamber music. I still do. That's very important because the process of hearing becomes more and more acute. The more you learn about music, the more you play music, the better it is when you put an instrument down and start waving your arms. You've got to learn how to conduct. You've got to learn 1-2, 1-2-3, 1-2-3-4, etc., etc. And that takes no time at all. I mean, you can do that in a couple of months. But the rest of it is a life journey. And I can tell you that it took me a good 10 years to finally say to a few friends of mine, you know what? I think I conducted okay tonight. I think I'm beginning to understand what this is all about. It takes that long. Well, guess what? When you're playing an instrument and you start at the age of 5, let's say, you know, by 15, you are almost there, you know? And that's got to do with teaching. It's got to do with environment, a whole bunch of things. And so conducting is a very, very difficult profession. As Zubin Mehta says, it's not 90 people. It's 180 eyes. And boy, when 180 eyes are looking at you, let me tell you, that's scary.
And it is all about eye contact, isn't it?
A lot of it is, sure. You have to have a physical ability. You have to have an energy that translates to the musicians. Yes, I'll play for that guy. And you know what? They'll tell you within a minute the artist say, yes, that's good, or, ah, no, I don't want to see that guy again, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's it. You got to have that. That's an inborn something that a person has to have when you're conducting, or for that matter, when you're playing. Some people are more attuned to playing the piano than playing the harp. You know what I'm saying? I'm being facetious, but I mean it.
Well, speaking of playing, that's one of the things that sets you apart from a lot of musicians, is the fact that you're a violinist and a violist. That was recommended to you by Joseph Gingold, and you actually recommend this to your students to explore more than one instrument. Is that right?
Absolutely. We judge that very carefully. Patty Kopeck and I have been working together for 25 years at the Manhattan School of Music, amongst other places. Ottawa, in Israel, we had a seminar from 90 to 96. So we are very careful about choosing who should begin to maybe go over from the violin to the viola, for that matter, viola to the violin. But nevertheless, said that, I think what's important is that they realize there sometimes when you put your hand on the viola, it suits a person better than the violin. That doesn't mean they should give up playing the violin, but they should learn how it feels. The bow distribution is a little wider angle. The string is a little thicker, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So when they feel good about playing the viola, we keep playing the viola. And we have had transformation of a few fiddle players to almost full-time viola players, and they're doing extremely well, both in quartets and orchestra leading viola sections, chamber music, and so on.
Well, sometimes, even during a performance, you will switch between instruments. What does that require of you as a performer?
A glass of water.
And a five-minute break in between.
No, I tell you, it's natural. It's a very natural extension for me, certainly after all these years. You learn, first of all, it's the same instrument, and I'm very lucky I have a fantastic viola, which I purchased about 25, 30 years ago now. It's actually the top is the father of my violin. The bottom and the sides are the grandfather of my violin. And it's the whole Guarneri family. It's that particular DNA, which is unique. So anyway, it's just one of those special things to have on top of being able to play it. It's a wonderful thing to have that instrument in my possession. So I'm very lucky that way. And so I just... I do now, when I play viola, I try to have the intermission to get back to the fiddle a little bit, and not only to warm up my hand for the fiddle, but also to warm up the instrument. I have 5 minutes, 7 minutes, something like that. So that's all. I don't play the viola all that much. Most recently, I played Bartok Viola Concerto. I'm going to play it again soon, Harold in Italy, and I've done a recording of Telemann recently, again with my former orchestra in Ottawa. I play some chamber music on the viola. I used to play it quite a bit more, but not as much now.
Well, you mentioned how it has to be in your DNA, and you have said that you were born to play music. Can you explain that?
Well, some people are born to be chefs, some people are born to be airline pilots, and I was born to play music, to play the violin. It's a very natural extension. It always has been it's been my friend since I can remember, and it continues to be. However, what I have to say to you, Julie, is that I practice every morning. I go into that little studio of mine and open the case and play my scales. The fundamentals. I just did an hour and a half this morning. I'm going to Tanglewood this evening. I practice every day, regardless of time change or what city I'm in. Sometimes because of airplanes being 12 or 14 hours in a day, flying or at night, it's hard to do that. But I no more than a day goes by where I don't actually practice my fundamentals. And that's longevity.
That's good for any young musician to hear who's a little frustrated having to always play scales.
Well, you don't have to only play scales, but scales are very important. It opens up your ears every day. You hopefully to play cleaner. You play Bach every day. I was given a tremendous education, but some of the greatest icons. Galamian was one of the greatest minds that ever came across a violin. And he gave us tremendous information, and hence why I think we are better teachers today because of him. It's amazing. I hear his voice nonstop now when I teach.
Will you share how Isaac Stern and Pablo Casals impacted your life early on?
Well, Isaac was one of these guys that I admired. I wanted to have the same car. I wanted the same house. I wanted to have everything he had. But he really spent time with me in a way that I think very few people in a lifetime or any lifetime have with a mentor. It was unique. I spent time with the family up in Connecticut. He had a house. I would go there and spend 10 days, and we would work on the Beethoven Violin Concerto, for example, the beginning of that piece, maybe 3 days, analyzing it, dissecting it, arguing about this and that and the other. Playing with him later on was an incredible experience. With him, Lenny Rose, conducting for him also was amazing. He had a wealth of information that came from an incredible life as a musician. And seeing him also in the other medium, which was how he handled the people around Carnegie Hall, how he handled the people in Mishkenot in Jerusalem when he built that place for teaching, for students, for philosophers, for people of knowledge to come and have a place to breathe and deal with the problems that exist in the world. He was a man that was self-educated, i.e., I'm the same. I just could never sit in a classroom. And I can tell you one sentence he said to me here in New York. He said, "Pinky, be a sponge." I said, "What? What are you, go buy a sponge?" He said, "I'm talking about your brain." He said, "Be a sponge. Just take it all in. You're in the greatest city of art and music and people and everything that's happening. Just keep your eyes and ears open and be a sponge." And I said, okay, I got it. So, you know, I was very, again, incredibly lucky.
I wanted to ask you about what I think is your first recording. Was it the Vaughan Williams, The Lark Ascending, in 1974?
My first recording? No, I've made recordings. The first recording of that piece, yeah.
Okay, of that piece, all right. I wanted to ask you about that because a colleague of mine was telling me yesterday that's that very piece of music, you performing it with the English Chamber Orchestra, is what introduced him to classical music, and he found that piece to be so powerful. And he told me that there's actually a pretty interesting story behind that recording that you made.
Yeah, there is. By the way, I just recorded it again recently, back in September, with the Royal Philharmonic, playing and conducting myself. So that's the second time I recorded it for Decca. But never mind all that. That's neither here nor there. What happened was I was staying in London in those days at the Westbury Hotel, amongst many other places. And I was living there quite a bit. So I had a call on a Sunday night from Daniel Barenboim. He said, "What are you doing tomorrow around 2 o'clock? I said, "Not much." He said, "I'm going to be sending you a piece by Vaughan Williams for violin and orchestra called The Lark Ascending." I said, "Danielczyk, what's a lark?" He said, "That's a bird." I said, "Okay, from where?" He said, "From Schott's." Schott's was up the street, past Regent Street, not far, but 2.5-3 blocks. "It'll be there by 10:15. I want you to come and record it at 2 o'clock at Wembley." I said, "You're not serious." He said, yeah. He said, "Every concertmaster in London plays it. You can sight read it. Don't worry about it." I said, "Okay." No, I didn't know. I never heard of the piece. So at 10:15, sure enough, comes the package. I open it up, and it's all ad libitum. It's all basically violin alone. I figured, well, that's easy enough. You know, I can do that. Then I turned the next page. I went, uh-oh. There are a few passages there you really had to practice. I never heard the piece. I got there. I was still practicing in the car. And they had a break. They had recorded from 10 to 1 or something like that. And so at 2 o'clock, I got in front of the orchestra, which I knew, of course, and I started to play. And I played through the whole piece. And the concertmaster was a very good friend of mine, Ken Silito. He said, "Pinky, have you ever played this before?" I said, "I've never heard it until now." He said, "You're kidding." I said, "No." He said, "That's amazing. How do you know how to do this?" I said, "I don't know. I'm just reading the notes." And that's it. We recorded about an hour, maybe an hour and 15 minutes. We did a couple of full takes and a few inserts, and that was it. Bye-bye. See you later.
So it was definitely your, you know, just kind of your bringing a fresh perspective to it, but not really even knowing how the piece was supposed to go. I guess that's an interesting approach, huh? If we could do that with more pieces, I guess that's why we commission works and premiere new works.
Well, I was eating up music. I still do. I literally eat music. I don't just play it. I mean, I look at the music and I know kind of what I need to do in it. A new piece, an old piece, doesn't matter. And the pieces that I've played many times, I just try and reinvent myself in a way to say, okay, should I try this? Should I try that? And I usually go back to what I did before. But when I was eating music up every day, I was playing pieces, new pieces. I was conducting. I was learning music 24/7. And I still do, by the way. So that's what I do. That's my life, you know. I try to improve. With more knowledge, you get more knowledge. And with more knowledge, you get more information on how to do it, hopefully better. If your physical dexterity stays normal, there shouldn't be any real problems of doing it for a very long time. And there are a few people that have done it. Rubinstein was one on the piano. Milstein, of course, on the fiddle. He was 82. He played his last recital in Stockholm. Knowing these kind of guys gave me, and Kazatz, my God, I heard him play when he was 88, 89 years old, you know. It was amazing. So, yeah, I had a pretty good upbringing on all sides.
Well, I started to wonder, well, how many recordings have you actually made? And I kind of lost count. It looks like there's about 105. So what's represented in this box set is only maybe a fourth or less of your catalog. Why is this being released now? What's important about what's in this collection?
You have to ask them. I have no idea.
It wasn't your idea. Is that what you're saying?
No, it definitely, believe me, it was not. It came by complete surprise. I had no idea. They said it's all the works I've done, all the recordings for Deutsche Grammophon. I said, fine, you know, that's great. I'm very happy. And then I wrote a blurb on it, which was corrected by my manager, Shirley, and they took a picture, and that's the end of the story.
All right. Is there anything else you want to add, maybe about your teaching and use of the internet with classical music? Because I know we have to wrap this conversation up.
Well, internet is a very wide word. I think we should be talking more on video conferencing, what used to be video. Now it's called real time. I was introduced to that in 1994, and it blew my mind. I thought, my God, this is a great vehicle for bringing music, certainly teaching, if not performing also. And it's coming around now, where we've got streaming from many places. We need to work out some particular red tape problems that we have with unions and orchestra members that will understand, or hopefully will understand in the future, that this is a money maker. Given the beginnings, we all have to really put something into this at the beginning of it. And it's only 22, 23 years old, but now people really have caught on. We need wiring. We need the kind of networking that is beginning to happen more in Europe than it is here. So low latency, for example, that's a very important. You can play 2,000, 3,000 kilometers away with the same person and there's no interference. Things like that. We can go to many elderly with this equipment. We need the lines. We need the depth of it. We need 125,000 megabits. We only have about 16 right now. So obviously for music and sound, that's very important. So we need that networking. And I think it'll happen. It's happening daily now.
Oh, you know, the only other thing I wanted to ask you very quickly, is it true that you used to carry a tennis racket in your violin case?
Yep, when the rackets were wooden, I was enamored by Jimmy Connors. I thought that guy was unbelievable. I saw him play when he was 19 in Wimbledon. He beat Ken Rosewall, and I was crying because we all wanted Ken to win. You know, he was 35 at that time, old-timer. Anyway, he came out with that 2000 racket, and I was playing tennis. By the time I landed, I had already an arrangement to go to the club right away in that city to play an hour, maybe 2 hours of just hitting the ball. And I used to know which concerto I was playing. I used to know which time I had to quit playing tennis. So I think the Beethoven concerto was about 6:30. Sibelius was 5:30. You know, things like that, Tchaikovsky and so on. So I, because I love the game. I just adore the game. I got very into this whole psychological aspect of what happens with the fundamentals. For example, you look at a Federer, for example. He misses one little backhand, and what does he do? On the way back, on the way, he's already doing his fundamentals. He's hitting that backhand in the air. So I thought, well, the Inner Game of Tennis came out, the book, which is very important for all of us to learn what happens in the subconscious. And that's it. So I got more and more into it. Unfortunately, I never became Jimmy Connors.
Or fortunately, depending on how you want to look at that, for those of us who love your music.
That's sweet.
Thank you so much for your time. I know you need to go, and I do as well. So thank you so much. I really appreciate you making time for this conversation.
Stay safe, Julie.
Alrighty, you too. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
That was Pinkus Zukerman. Over the next 6 weeks, I'm counting down my 6 favorite interviews of the year from new classical tracks. Next week, a conversation with violinist Rachel Barton Pine. I'm Julie Amacher, and this is New Classical Tracks Uncut.